This is a book about a guy from down country who's come to Vermont with a goal. He wants to prove once and for all that there's some kind of a critter living in Lake Champlain. Now, you all know about Champ, right? Mm-hmm. Is there someone who doesn't know about the Lake Champlain monster? Yeah, you wouldn't admit it, would you? You don't know. Okay. Hold on. So he's come to Vermont with the idea that he wants to prove that there's something mysterious and monstrous in the lake, something like the Loch Ness Monster, which I'm sure you've heard of. Yes. And part of his research is that he's not only saved up magazine and newspaper articles, but he's also got a bunch of tapes that he recorded off what we used to call Vermont Public Radio. He's got tapes of people who are being interviewed who have sighted the monster. So this first reading is one of those tapes. It's what he's listening to as he's in his car driving north towards Lake Champlain. And as this scene begins, he pops his cassette, remember those? Pops his cassette into his cassette player in his, I forgot what kind of car he's driving, probably an Audi or something like that. But anyway, here's what he listens to. And just one thing before I get started, I want you to know that I was born here in Vermont, and what growing up I've done, I did here. So I have a perfect right to talk the way I'm about to. So this is Oliver Ransom, recorded on a cassette tape from what we used to call Vermont Public Radio. Now, let me see if I can get this just right. It was late August, early September. It was after work, early evening. Me and my boy, Cliff, I guess he was about 15 at the time, we was out in my boat, little aluminum 12-footer from Sears. We was in the bay. What's that? Oh, it was St. Albans Bay, east of Friars Island. That lake was real calm and dark, just like a big sheet of black ice. Anyways, it started to get dark out, and I could see red in the sky. It was thick black clouds overhead. There was something about that calm. Like any second, them big clouds are going to pucker up, let loose one hell of a rainstorm. There wasn't no wind to speak of. Clouds weren't moving, neither. Neither was the water. Everything was real calm. Real... Something about that kind of evening makes you want to talk in whispers. Know what I mean? Makes you feel real close to whoever it is you're with. Of course, that's the best time of day for fishing. And all around us, off in the distance, there was little boats with fellas sitting in them, just like me and Cliff. Just had one fisherman, some had more. Nobody was paying no attention, nobody else. Fishing's that way, don't you know, kind of a private thing. Well, sir, everybody was just watching their lines, looking at the little spot where it disappears under the water, waiting for it to move, waiting for some fish to take it. Now, it's this next part I want to get just right for you. I want you to see it just the way I done. Now, I already told you how quiet it was, and Cliff, well, he's a quiet boy. Oh, he's got his share of the devil in him, same as any boy, but Cliff's devil is a quiet one. And anyway, he says to me, Dad, I ain't got somebody. Well, sir, I figure he's kidding, having a little joke. That is, until that fish ball of his bends just about in half, bends nearly to breaking. And I can see he's hooked into something pretty big, wallowing most likely, or maybe a big-ass bass or something. Let up on your drag, I hollers at him. You could hear that drag screeching as the thing pulls out line. No point trying to reel in too much fish heading for deep water. And the tip of that boy's pole is vibrating like the tail of a rattler. And old Cliff, he's getting scat. "What is it, Dad?" he says. There's a look on his face like he's trying to cover up how scared he is. I see him sweating and shaking. I know how he feels. "Let her take mine," I tells him. "Let her have all she wants." Right now I'm thinking maybe he's hooked into one of them salmon or maybe a big lager. And Cliff's pulling real hard and the thing's taking line. That old pole of his, why, it's bent around like one of them divining rods over spring. And we're both anxious to see what he's got there. And Cliff, he keeps looking at me and then at the water, and he's sweating more and more, and he's looking more and more scared. And finally he says, "Here, Dad, you bring him in." He starts to hand me his pole. Well, I figure it's his fish, so I says, "No, sir, you play it out." But before we can argue about it, the fight stops. Now, if you ain't a fisherman, you don't know that feeling of terrible calm right after your line goes limp and your fish gets away. It's a lonely feeling, a feeling of failure. Well, Cliff, he's looking brokenhearted as can be as he's winding in his line. Don't know how many feet of it. Me, I don't know whether to say, "Let's go home," or "Let's try a few more casts." I mean, we both know there's something pretty goddamn, excuse me, something pretty awful darn big out there, but common sense tells us we ain't gonna get another crack at it tonight. So Cliff's reeling in, and I'm trying to think of something nice to say to him, when all of a sudden, something hits the boat, ka-thunk. Sounds as though we've bottomed out on a submerged log. See, but the thing is, we ain't moving at all. Plus, why, cripes, we're way the heck out in the middle of the lake. I mean, any logs or stones or anything like that have to be 30, 40 feet straight down. I think both of us got real scared then. And I could see Cliff shivering. And then he lets out, and then Cliff lets out a holler like the devil himself, jumped right up and bit him on the ass. Sorry. I mean, on the behind, this fish pole jumps right out of his hands, and then it dives right into the water and heads down and underneath the boat. Well, heck, I figure whatever he's hooked into never really got away. She just doubled back and swam right in under the boat. And I'll tell you one thing, mister, no fish I ever seen him do that. So I make a grab for Cliff's pole when she comes out the other side. But hell, she's moving way too fast. I caught myself on the monofilament. So we're just sitting there, looking out over the water, trying real hard to see what it is that's playing with us. And we're looking down, trying to see if it's swimming under the boat again. But for a long time, nothing happens. It just keeps getting later and darker. And some of them other boats has gone in. I remember how you could see their lights reflected in the water, as if the reflection, with the reflection of the moon, and no mirror was ever any smoother than the surface of that lake. Anyways, just then, I seen something kind of moving off to the right side of the boat, off towards Millville Landing. The water starts rippling and churning, and then it's like one of them logs that ain't supposed to be there is coming right up out of the water, bobbing right up to the surface. And all of a sudden, and Cliff seen it too, this black pointy head comes right up out of the lake. The head and neck is kind of jutting out on an angle like the blade of a switchblade opening up. I see water dripping off it as it comes higher and higher out of the lake. And I'm thinking to myself, why, God free mighty, that can't be real. But it keeps coming and coming, like a snake or crawling out of his hole. It's all black, don't you know? It's shining. And it's evil looking, like something out of one of them old scary movies. And in the moonlight, I can see Cliff's nightcrawler, all white and puffy looking, hanging out of its mouth. And monofilament line, just like a long strand of silver thread, trailing off into the lake. Must have been 6 foot ahead and neck jumping out of that water. And I'll tell you, mister, I wasn't interested in seeing what sort of body that neck was hooked onto. But you know, the funny thing. I mean the thing I'm going to remember just as long as I live is the way that head turned slow and easy like, just like a lighthouse or maybe a periscope on a submarine. And it kept on turning until its eyes locked right tight on me and my boy. I tell you, I looked straight into the eyes of that thing, and it looked straight into mine. It didn't act scared of nothing. We just kept looking, eye to eye, as if the thing was trying to remember me, like it was trying to memorize everything about me, so it wouldn't never forget. You better believe I'll never be able to forget it, though. And I'm here to tell you, I sure as hell want to. Anyways, after a while, it just slides back into the water without a sound, just as if it had never been there at all. And me and Cliff, well, sir, we hightailed it for home. You know, it's there's a little bit of my father in that story. My father was something of a storyteller. He wasn't a literate sort of guy. He didn't write his stories, but he told them. And I think Oliver Ransom's mode of telling a story was similar to my father's, that he'd take a short story like that and drag it out for hours and build up a sense of suspense and tension and then get on to something else, which is what we're going to do. I love this. This is great. Do you guys like to be read to?
Yes.
I think it's great. I don't care which side of the lectern I'm on. I like to be read to, but I also like to read. And my habit is always that I prepare way too much stuff. So, you know, there's, in addition to the volume control, there's also, you know, the speeded up signal. So it's all fairly modular. I can take things away or insert them, but whatever. This next tale is one you may possibly have heard, but it is more than deserving of preservation. Of all weird Vermont stories, this, I think, is the undisputed granddaddy. And with winter coming on, this is a chilling tale indeed. It began in December 21st, 1887, as a front page story in the Montpelier Argus and Patriot. That was a popular weekly newspaper that was published in our state's capital. The correspondent, the writer, who signed himself only with his initials, A.M., told of startling events recorded in his uncle William's diary. The published article was titled A Strange Tale, but by any standards, today's or yesterday's, it was a tale of sheer Gothic horror. The action occurred in the mountains some 20 miles from Montpelier. I have been to the place, A.M. assures us, and I have seen the old log house where the events took place, and talked with an old man who vouched for the truth of the story, and that his father was one of the parties operated on. Operated on. This is what was going on in the back hills of Vermont back then. The article detailed how one secluded community solved the problem of how to stretch its meager food supply through the long, cold Vermont winter. In his January 7th entry, Uncle William explained, and I quote, "The dwellers, who are unable either from age or other reasons to contribute to the support of the families are disposed of in a manner that will shock the one who reads this diary. Then he tells of drugging four men and two women. One of the men, he says, a cripple, about 36 years old. The other five past the age of usefulness. At night, the bodies were stripped, carried outside, and left to freeze in the bitter, cold mountain air. Uncle William watched as their noses, ears, and fingers turned white beneath the full moon. He saw their ghastly, upturned faces assume what he called a callowy look, watching in mounting horror until finally he ran inside to escape the nightmare. But what he witnessed turned out to be more than a simple, perhaps merciful form of euthanasia. 4 months later, Uncle William's entry for May 10th revealed a stranger outcome. During a spring thaw, Uncle William returned to the mountain cabin. He saw the frozen bodies released from their icy crypt, then placed in troughs made of hemlock logs. Slowly, color brightened their features. Muscles twitched, fingers moved, vitality returned. In time, the six were taken inside, where they were warmed by blankets, fire, and a hearty meal, completely revived after their long winter hibernation. Truly, the writer concluded, truth is stranger than fiction. Now, this eerie story, published at a time when journalistic truth was rarely etched in Vermont granite, vanished for about 50 years. It was then rediscovered and in 1939 reprinted in the Rutland Herald, the state's second largest newspaper at the time. The Boston Globe picked it up, so did Yankee Magazine, the Old Farmer's Almanac, and a fair number of other books and periodicals, giving it wide and eventually worldwide exposure. While most people dismissed it as an especially grisly mountain myth, many others, including some scientists, believed it. For years, this was perhaps Vermont's most well-known believe-it-or-not type tale. It made the rounds all over the world, and one wonders how it made other people feel about us Vermonters. Even today, people ask me, is there any truth to this freezing the old people business? Oh, I'm sure it happened, I tell them. And in truth, I really believed it. First, when I first heard it when I was a little boy, probably from my father. But did it really happen? Some time ago, the longtime editor of Yankee Magazine, Judson Hale, decided to get to the bottom of things, and he came to Vermont and he found the area where the story most certainly took place, up around Callis. And he talked to a bunch of people and he found this old farmer couple. And he said, he asked them, do you believe that story? Certainly do, the farmer said. And his wife chimed in and said, well, it's the part of that thawing out I'm not so sure about. Anyway, you may find some similarities between that story and this next one. This next tale comes from Brandon, Vermont. I want to tell you about something ridiculously weird, but not especially scary, if you don't give it too much thought. During the summer of 1865, workmen digging a new mine shaft made an impossible discovery. At a depth of 114 feet, they unearthed a body. was the body of a giant bullfrog. This oversized amphibian was snugly packed in a pocket of hardened mud that was contoured precisely to its form. Experts guessed it must have been preserved there for thousands, possibly millions of years. This unusual find quickly attracted considerable attention. First, because the specimen was so perfectly preserved. Second, because it was found at such great depth. And third, because of its remarkably large size. From the tip of its nose to the end of its spine, that frog measured 14 inches. And some might say that's a lot of bull. It was at this point that things started to get weirder. And if I may say, more Halloween-like. After a few hours, this Brobdingnagian bullfrog started to twitch and jerk. And then, fully animated, it began hopping backward in a spastic, convulsive manner. Then, finally, some kind-hearted townsperson managed to seize the frog and transport it safely to a nearby pond. There it lived happily for many years. And during summer nights, Brandon's giant bullfrog bellowed so loudly that it could be heard for miles around. I call that one the frog that didn't croak. You know, I like that story, and I read it and share it every chance I get, but I sort of doubt it, you know. It's kind of hard after all these years to go back and prove it one way or another, but it is in the Brandon history books. But what's lacking is a taxidermied specimen in the Brandon Historical Museum, or any other museum that I've been able to find. You would think that if there was such a marvelous specimen in their midst, they would save it somehow. Even the shell that surrounded this basketball-sized shell that surrounded this thing apparently wasn't preserved. Now, the charm of a story like this, of course, is that it doesn't disprove it. The taxidermied frog, or maybe the thing that encapsulated his body, might be in somebody's attic or somebody's barn somewhere around Brandon, in an old, dusty wooden crate surrounded by hay, packed by hay or sawdust. It could be there. This could turn out to be true. Anyway, that's just silly. I mean, bottom line is that's just a silly story. But we're supposed to be gearing up for Halloween. So let's put aside lake monsters and frozen farmers and giant bullfrogs. And in honor of the sinister season, let's talk about ghosts. Now, to be fair and objective, perhaps there's nothing uniquely Vermont about Vermont ghosts. Ghosts are pretty universal and essentially similar from culture to culture. I think it's the Vermonters themselves, the ghosts' hosts, if you will, who are unique. Vermonters simply don't make much of a big deal about them, or much of anything else, actually. Vermonters have been happily cohabiting with their spectral housemates for centuries. It's just that we're stereotypically taciturn about it. I recall the time I asked one old fella up around Swanton how he felt about his resident specter. "Well," he replied, "it don't eat much." Another favorite was told to me by my friend Joan Connor, who lives in the tiny unincorporated community of Belmont down by Mount Holly, if you know where that is. One day she was visiting a neighboring farmer. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she heard what she was certain was the sound of snoring coming from the room beside the kitchen. Now, Joan knew very well that the man was a lifelong bachelor. Nonetheless, she inquired, perhaps somewhat timidly, "Are you having trouble with raccoons or something?" "Nope," the farmer assured her. "That's just Mr. Parker taking his nap." Well, perplexed, she tactfully dropped the topic. And it was sometime later that she learned that Mr. Parker had been the previous owner of the house, and he had died there and had been napping in his nearby grave for more than 60 years. So with all that in mind, I want to reveal to you the location of the wildest Vermont ghost story that I know. Though it is not a well-known location for ghosts, this haunted hotspot combines history and haunting in a rather elegant upper crust sort of way. You may have heard of the location. It's called the Equinox. Ring any bells?
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll just suffer a dramatic pause here while I... Since colonial times, the Equinox Hotel has been linked with every phase of Manchester, Vermont history. It began as a humble tavern. Over the years, it has expanded and blossomed into one of New England's finest resorts. I remember it during the 1960s and 70s when I was living in nearby Chester, Vermont. The hotel had fallen onto bad times. Its pale and peeling remains reminded me of some giant Jurassic roadkill sprawled along Route 7. In 1973, it took its last breath, just 1 year after it was awarded a long-deserved place on the National Register of Historic Places. It closed, and the shadow of the wrecking ball swung closer with each passing season. But unlike the dinosaurs, the Equinox came back from the dead. A decade later, there began a multi-million dollar restoration that would return it to its former splendor. But the resuscitation may have brought something else back as well. When I first visited the hotel, I was researching my book, Green Mountains, Dark Tales. I spoke with the head concierge, Linda Malachuk, who was quite open, surprisingly so, about the inn's peculiar propensities. She told me that housekeepers were afraid to enter certain rooms because of unaccountable noises, rapid changes in air temperature, or things that vanished in one place and then reappeared somewhere else. "There's a lot of disturbances up on the third and fourth floors," Linda told me. "At night, when the security men go around to do their checks, they'll find a door will be open, and they'll look in, and for no reason at all, the shade has flown up on the window, and it's kind of wiggling in place, and the rocking chair is rocking with no one in it. Once, in a certain locked room on the second floor, ice chests, chairs, and other things suddenly appeared. They were discovered piled up like a pyramid, stacked one on top of another, right in the middle of the room. There was no explanation of how the stuff got there or who piled it up." Linda suspects the problem started with the hotel's renovation. And personally, I suspect that is because dead Vermonters, like living Vermonters, don't much like change. Anyway, she thought the scariest occurrence involved the security guard who was summoned to the room of four panic-stricken guests. As Linda described him, he's a very strong Vietnam vet. He's seen it all. But when he saw what was happening in room 329, he turned around and walked out. Very weird, I thought. So I figured I'd better talk to him directly. And so I did. Robert Cullinan had started working at the Equinox as a security guard in 1985. Soon after that, Robert told me, he and several other guards regularly experienced an odd multi-sensual phenomenon on the third floor. He described it this way, and I'm quoting directly, although I won't try to do his voice. You can be walking through there in the middle of the night, and you can hear somebody approaching you. You can hear the footsteps. You can feel the air around you getting colder and colder, and at a certain point, it feels like a freezer is passing right through you. And then you can hear the footsteps continue on behind you. There have also been voices, he told me. People talking to you, tapping you on the shoulder. You turn around and there's absolutely nothing there. Later, after an hour or so of trust building, Robert finally revealed the weirdest experience of all. It was your typical night, Robert began. Thunder and lightning, just like you read about. A gentleman and his wife called and said they were experiencing some very disturbing things in their room and could we please come up and fix them. So I knocked on the door and they said, come in, and I used my pass key and I opened the door. Just the initial walking in and I was dumbstruck. The rocking chairs were going. The shades on the lights were spinning, not fast, but they were going around in a circle. And by God, the bed was moving across the floor. Now, this man and his wife were over in the corner with eyes about the size of garbage can lids. And his two kids were totally freaked. They were scared to death. They were crying. So I walked in the middle of the room and I asked them, are you seeing the same thing that I'm seeing? And he said, yes. About the same time, I'm in the middle of the room and there's nothing else around me. Now, I'm not particularly a lightweight. I go about 220. It felt like somebody had their hand underneath my feet and just gave me a shove. And I came darn close to a foot up into the air, and then I came back down. And that's when I told this gentleman, I'd be happy to move you to another room, sir, but I'm out of here. As that unusual night progressed, other Equinox employees witnessed similar strangeness. Robert told me there were six other written reports on it. I wouldn't tell anybody until I found out that other people had experienced the same thing. Over time, I've come to question the long-accepted notion that there is some relationship between people dying in a place and their ghosts remaining on site. But whether that's true or false, people continue to guess who the Equinox ghosts might be. Linda Malachuk said that sometimes people hear the sounds of an unknown mother trying to comfort a whining child. Others are more specific. They suspect it's the ghostly remains of Mary Todd Lincoln. Mrs. Lincoln loved the Equinox and enjoyed returning there year after year. Apparently, she had made reservations to bring Abraham there in 1865, but as we know, fate had other plans for him. Another suspect is William Marsh, who owned the original tavern on the Equinox's site. His land was taken away when he turned Tory, and maybe he just feels that if he hangs around long enough, we'll give it back. Then, there's a small, secretive contingent of individuals who have a slightly more grisly explanation. In the old days, a jail was contained within the hotel. And local rumor has it that during the 1980s hotel renovations, human bones were discovered there. My informant said, instead of turning them in, because it would cause disruption to the construction, they just tossed them into a dumpster. Well, Maybe so, maybe not. But the files of ghost lore are full of phantoms whose activities are provoked by misplaced bones. One of the things that's really amazing to me about this story is that the people at the Equinox talked about these so freely. Because at that time, I was doing research, and I couldn't get other people to talk. When I did my first collection of strange Vermont stories, I wanted to do a section on haunted hotels and inns and B&Bs. And just from living around here, I had heard stories connected with a fair number of them. So I would call these places up, and I would say, well, you know, I'm doing a book about Vermont folklore, and, you know, do you have any, you know, ghost stories or strange tales connected with your hotel? Nope, nothing like that. I couldn't get anybody to talk. Now, this was around 1995, and there's been a tremendous cultural shift since then, as you know, because now it's very difficult to find a B&B, tavern, or hotel that doesn't have a ghost. this whole thing of tourism makes ghosts and such things very much in demand. I had a similar situation. I was trying to look at haunted houses. Just from hanging around with my father as a kid, I knew where a number of haunted houses were supposed to be. But I wanted to find out more. I wanted to do sort of a census of Vermont haunted homes or something like that. And so I was asking myself, well, how do I find out about haunted houses? I got it. I'll call some realtors. So I'd probably be exaggerating if I said that I called a dozen realtors, probably more like five or six, but to a person. No, we don't know anything about any haunted houses. I couldn't get any information from realtors. And years later, I realized that I'd simply asked the wrong question. What I should have said was, I'd like to buy a haunted house. Anyway, got the energy for another one?
Yes.
All right. This next story is one I'm very much trying to keep alive. For some reason, it hasn't received much modern attention. I discovered it in an 1874 newspaper while I was researching the Eddy brothers. But apparently other writers have not discovered it. In the mid-1870s, certain local and some out-of-state newspapers reported some highly strange goings-on in the town of North Pownall, down near Bennington. It seems that Thomas Paddock, described by the Burlington Free Press and Times as a respectable farmer of excellent character, suddenly found his property under seemingly supernatural assault. Sometime during October 1874, a mysterious shower of stones began to rain down on his house and outbuildings. They fell, the newspaper reported, intermittently and apparently from the blue arched heavens without any visible mortal aid. Fearing spirits, or something worse, Mr. Paddock and his family tried to keep the strange events a secret. But eventually word got out, and the stones continued to fall. They rained night and day, the farmer reported, and they varied in size from tiny pebbles to 4 or 5 inches in diameter. In late November, a veritable boulder weighing more than 20 pounds dropped out of nowhere. It landed with sufficient velocity to make a 3-inch impression in the frozen ground. Later, amazed visitors to the farm attempted to duplicate this phenomenon by hurling similarly sized rocks at the earth. But no one could create more than a slight impression in the solid soil. New York's Troy Press reported other oddities in the behavior of stones. For one thing, when they t- touched down, they did not skip or bounce as they would if someone threw them. Instead, they tended to, I quote, roll along as if propelled by some unseen power. Stranger still, when examined, the landed stones were found to be warm and sometimes hot, even in the chill winter nights. The Troy Press also reported what is perhaps the strangest behavior of a rock on record. They said, sometimes they strike the roof near the eaves and slowly climb the roof over the peak and roll off the other side. The puzzled farmer sought help from trusted local sages. He even offered a small reward to anyone who, he said, as he said, would rise and explain the mystery to his satisfaction. But no one rose, and no one explained, and the stones continued to fall. Nowadays, we probably refer to these strange events as poltergeist phenomena. But back then, an equally valid explanation was spirit assault, or more dramatically, a stone-throwing devil. And we can't ignore the most enfeebling label, a hoax. Yeah, the Burlington newspaper maintained that the paddock house was situated in such a way that no one could hide and throw the stones without being detected. The local wise men, after careful consideration, were thoroughly satisfied that Farmer Thomas Paddock was telling the truth. To the people of North Pownall, the stone throwing began and ended in mystery. And as far as I know, it's still a mystery. We don't have a lot of poltergeist stories here in Vermont. This next one is a relatively new story. Well, actually, it's another old story, but it was completely lost and forgotten until I discovered it quite recently. In fact, I discovered it during the pandemic, and I've tried to dig up more information, but apparently it was not widely reported, so I'm putting it on the endangered list. It took place not too far from where I live in Windsor, birthplace of Vermont, and just a bit south of the teeming tourist mecca of Woodstock, in a tiny village called Hemmonsville, which is actually part of Reading. Something really strange happened there. It was around 1860, and as far as I can tell, it was documented only once in a single issue of the Religio-Philosophical Journal. See, I read odd things. But a family there was startled by violent rapping on the outside of their house. It came back night after night, but search as they might, they could never discover what was causing it. When the owner mentioned it to his neighbors, he learned that they too were experiencing a similar pounding phenomenon. In fact, the same thing was happening in houses all over town, all at the same time. The rapping would begin on the west side of the buildings, always commencing around 6 p.m. and would continue till 10 and sometimes later. No one could explain it, and the cause was never determined. It was as if the little town of Hammondsville were suddenly under siege by a mob of phantom rappers, and not the musical kind. These disturbances continued for about 3 months and were heard by dozens of locals. I discovered that some of the afflicted houses still stand, so I can't help but wonder if their present owners know about this particular bit of local history. It's a unique mystery, and like so many of these mysteries, I regret that we can't really travel back in time and try to figure out what was going on. But then again, that's the cool thing about paranormal mysteries too, I suppose. They're far better, it seems to me, when we don't have a solution. Like this next tale. It's good to keep in mind that not only ghosts can haunt you, stories can too. And so I share this next account with a certain sense of risk. It's one of the dangerous stories that I mentioned. Personally, I find it tremendously unsettling, but you may not. I mean, what scares one person simply bores another. This one is not frightening to listen to, but if you think about it later, maybe while you're trying to fall asleep, it can creep up on you. It can become close to terrifying. At least that was my experience. In their 1913 History of Reigate, Vermont, Edward Miller and Frederick Wells wrote, "If all the tales and traditions which linger among the hills of Reigate and Barnet have been gathered, they would form a volume which, in humor, pathos, and appeal to the deepest emotions of the heart, would be hard to surpass." And then Messrs. Miller and Wells set about to prove it with this uniquely unsettling tale from the 1800s. The events involve a young woman named Elizabeth McCallum, a 14-year-old daughter of two of the area's original Scottish settlers. Young Elizabeth was a great favorite in the village, known for her good manners and her cheerful disposition. One bright summer morning, her father sent her on an easy errand to the home of Dr. John McNabb, who lived to the east, not far from the Connecticut River. The McNabb place was several miles away on the other side of a thickly wooded area. So Elizabeth was permitted to take her favorite horse. It was a lovely July morning, so Elizabeth was delighted to have this errand to do, and she set out with a bright smile on her face. Some hours later, when at last she arrived at the McNabb house, she was in a state of agitation and wonder. Something strange and marvelous had happened in those woods. She was able to describe the spot with precision. It was a place Dr. McNabb knew well. Elizabeth told him how, when she approached that particular spot, virtually in the middle of nowhere, her progress was arrested by an unfamiliar sound. It was music, she insisted. Strange and beautiful music. It seemed to come from every direction, from all around, filling the air, enveloping all other sounds. She and her horse stopped and remained very still, listening in amazement. And when at last the beautiful music faded, they continued east. John McNabb and his family were quite taken by this fascinating account from so trustworthy a young woman. But he was puzzled. He could offer no explanation as to what she had heard or where such sounds might have originated. Elizabeth stayed for lunch and some conversation, and then about mid-afternoon she mounted her horse and set off along the same trail, returning home. I suspect she might have been hoping to hear the music again. That evening, Elizabeth's parents, John and Ellen McCallum, were ill at ease. Though it was a warm, pleasant evening, all was not right. Their daughter should have been home hours ago. Now, it was after 8 o'clock. Nighttime was descending rapidly, and still Elizabeth was nowhere to be seen. As darkness thickened, waiting became impossible. Mr. McCallum summoned a few of his nearest neighbors. Everyone grabbed lanterns or torches and set out along the darkened path toward the McNabb place. Within an hour, they found the horse without its young rider. And then they found Elizabeth. She was lying beside the trail, not far from the grazing animal. The young woman was dead. No marks or bruises could be discovered anywhere on her body.
There was no blood, no broken bones. In fact, there was nothing nearby nor on her person that could give the searchers any kind of clue about how she had met her end. Later, John McNabb and his wife told Mr. and Mrs. McCallum about the music Elizabeth said she had heard. Recalling Elizabeth's description, Dr. McNabb was able to tell that her body had been discovered lying dead at the exact spot where she had heard the mysterious melodies. Today, Elizabeth is remembered only by her gravestone in the churchyard. It says nothing about the mysterious music, but I can't help but wonder if it can still be occasionally heard resonating in the forests around Blue Mountain. With so much time having passed, it's difficult to retrofit modern explanations in an effort to solve this chilling little mystery. Couldn't have been cell phones, couldn't have been iPads, could have been radios. What could it have been?
A hallucination.
What?
Hallucination.
I'm afraid I didn't hear that, but probably not. certain town records tried to force it to closure by simply stating that Elizabeth was killed by falling from her horse. And maybe we should accept that because it avoids having to contemplate much more terrifying possibilities. To bring this little tale, this odd little tale, a little bit more up to date, there was one parapsychologist named Scott Rago who had a unique area of study. In fact, he was the only modern researcher I know of who has studied a mystical musical phenomenon heard by very few people, the so-called music of the spheres. Have you ever heard that term?
Yes.
Supposedly, on unpredictable occasions, certain individuals hear beautiful, awe-inspiring harmonies that seem to come from nowhere. The music is said to be so exquisite that one woman told Mr. Rogo that she would gladly die just to hear those heavenly harmonies again. Sounds like she might have been exaggerating a little bit, but I guess we'll never know. But in all my research, I found only one example of the music of the spheres here in Vermont, and that was the Elizabeth McCallum story. Her experience may be unique to Vermont, but apparently there are more similar cases elsewhere. But I should be quick to add that they do not invariably predict the immediate death of the listener. Most, apparently, according to Scott Rogo, are experienced by mystics, people in altered states of consciousness, or individuals who are already in the process of dying. Mr. Rogo wrote, "Perhaps all of us will hear those rapturous sounds when we make the great spiritual transition." Presumably, he found out for himself. Mr. Rogo died in 1990 at age 40, but the rest of us will just have to wait and see. Now, there are a lot more dangerous and endangered Vermont tales. I've been collecting them for about 3 decades, and I filled books with them. What I've shared tonight is but a sample, and it brings us to the final stop on our tour through the dark side of Vermont. And for the end of my appearance here tonight, we will venture to the place where all things end, the grave. I like to read the following story every Halloween. Sure, I risk making it tedious with repetition, but eventually it will become an established tradition, a sort of Dickensian holiday staple, like reading a Christmas carol every Christmas. And the grave I'm about to describe is a true rarity, the only one of its kind anywhere in Vermont. Now, if you should find yourself traveling along Route 7 in the area of New Haven, I suggest you make a short detour into town. And there you'll encounter one of a kind oddity that may haunt you for the rest of your life. Near the front of Evergreen Cemetery is a peculiar mound of earth, a small grass-covered hill that looks strangely out of place, like some sort of landscaping error. If you climb to its top, you'll encounter the last thing you'd ever expect to see. It's a window embedded in the ground. A window that, depending on your point of view, either looks up at the sky or directly down into the earth. If you look down and the visibility were good, you'd be staring face to face with the long dead corpse of Timothy Clark Smith. Timothy's body has been lying there, looking up and out at the sky since October of 1856. But a grave with a window? What mad Martha Stewart came up with that decorating nightmare? It all had to do with Mr. Smith's odd obsession. Though his early years were spent in Moncton, Vermont, he received a bachelor's degree from Middlebury College, and then, after graduating from the University of New York, he went on to become a doctor. Later, he found employment in the Foreign Service. And it was in that capacity, working as a physician, that this small town Vermonter had an opportunity to see the world. But working in Russia and Romania, he saw things far worse than that, hideous things, things that are, in fact, too grisly to even mention during this pleasant Halloween gathering. Delicately put, Dr. Smith apparently witnessed something so gruesome that it triggered his lifelong terror, a genuine terror of being buried alive, which I might add was not an unreasonable concern in those pre-embalming days. During the mid-1800s, there were over 200 recorded cases of people almost being buried alive and another 150 cases of actual live burials. Even more horrible, there are at least 10 cases on record of dissections commencing before the subject was actually dead. And two incidents where embalming began on living people. Anyway, during a visit back to Vermont in 1856, while staying at the Middlebury Inn, Timothy Clark Smith took sick and died. And I suppose it might be prudent to interject at this point that there's no causal relationship between being at the inn and him dying. He just happened to die there. Anyway, his family knew about his phobia, so they dealt with the situation the only way they could think of. They simply left his body in the hotel room and continued to pay the rent. And finally, good sense, or maybe bad sense, prevailed. Local authorities stepped in, demanding that Dr. Smith be removed and properly buried. He was then transported to the vault at New Haven's Evergreen Cemetery, where guards stood watch day and night in case he should suddenly come back to life. Meanwhile, a very special grave was being prepared for him, the round mound of earth. When Mr. Smith was finally laid to rest, his face was positioned beneath a cement tube that led to the surface. The tube was covered by a 14 by 14 inch square of plate glass, his window to the world. And in the corpse's hand, they placed a bell that he could ring if he woke up and to find himself a victim of premature burial. Now, as far as I know, that bell has never sounded. But if you decide to visit the grave, keep very quiet and listen. Timothy Clark Smith's legacy is an odd one. not only is his grave a mysterious place, but he set things up for a century's worth of scary stories. You see, he died on Halloween. Now, I've asked people around there if they knew any stories connected with the grave or the bell or the window or anything about this. One guy told me that when he was a kid, there was apparently a habitual over-drinker. Not sure what the politically correct term is anymore, but anyway, this guy was making his way home after over-drinking, and he was walking through the cemetery, and he heard the bell ringing. So he walked over to the grave, or up onto the grave, and he looked down through the glass and said, "What you want?" It's your only additional story I've come. Anyway, there you have it. A sampling of dangerous and endangered tales. I have no useful concluding remarks, except perhaps this one bit of wisdom that I always try to keep in mind. It's a quote from Charles Fort, one of the first and most influential collectors of anomalous phenomena, or what I like to call weird shit. And it's a notion with which I most heartily agree. He said, "I cannot say that truth is stranger than fiction, because I've never had acquaintance with either." Now just, I know this kind of goes on and on and on like the endless credits at the end of a movie, but I do want to remember my manners and thank Karen Rhodes for organizing this. And Artistry Community Arts Center for hosting me and my entourage of paranormal pets. And a special tip of the Citroën chapeau to F.G. Gillingham and Sons for sponsoring the event. They have long been and will long remain my favorite store. And they have a ghost. So go there, walk around. It's a creaky old place. It's just like walking into the past. And most of the people there, if you ask them about the ghost, they will tell you. Jira Billings, the owner, tells the story very well. But I learned it from his mother, Polly, and I'm not going to tell it now. But you'll have to come back next year. Next year I'll tell you. And now if you'll permit me, this is the last page, really, I promise. But if you'll permit me a brief commercial message, I'd like to take if you want to take a little bit of tonight home with you, see some of the stories that I didn't read. I got a bunch of books over there which I'd be happy to part with and sign if you wish. No pressure, but they're there. And finally, thank all of you so very much for your attention. This really does my heart good. And it's not hard on my ego either. It's very sustaining. And please keep in mind that just by listening to these stories, you're helping me to keep them alive. And you may pass some of them on. And so we'll keep these stories going. So if you have questions, or perhaps a story of your own, now's the time. I'm hoping some of you will have spooky stories. I'm hoping some of you will have questions, but I assure you most of them are not answerable. Or we can all just go home.